Hi, I'm Lainey, host of the True Crime Fan Club podcast. If you're a true crime aficionado like I am, then my show is for you. Join me as I peel back the curtains in this immersive storytelling podcast that reveals the life and crimes of some of the most evil minds. At the end of each episode, you'll be left wondering, how will you sleep tonight? Search for True Crime Fan Club Podcast in any podcast directory. You won't want to miss an episode.
True Consequences is a proud member of the Borellis Podcasters Guild.
Look deeper.
True Consequences is a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. I'm your host, Eric Carter Bondeen.
Welcome, everybody, to the newest episode of True Consequences. It's hard to believe that we're already at the end of the season. I think I have two more episodes left and then the season's over. Just for super fun times, I've brought your favorite crow back to hang out and call with me again. You love her. You hate her. There she is. Her name is Lydia.
Back to life. Back to reality. This is just like that time in the seventh grade where they started calling me Chlamydia Lydia after our sex week education in school. This is unfair and this is libelous.
Okay.
You'll be hearing from my lawyer.
Are you going to sue me?
Yes.
So, Lydia, so much scandal about you in particular.
I didn't realize it was so controversial that I had a cackle. I don't know. I feel like it's anti-Semitic, but I'm not going to say anything. Crows are known to be smart.
Yeah.
And they're also borderline creepy. And I feel like that kind of sums me up as a person.
I agree with that assessment of yourself.
Yeah. My little beady eyes.
Yeah. You're self-aware.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like trinkets.
Yeah. So you like to bring trinkets or steal trinkets?
Both.
Yeah. Okay. I want to say thank you to my newest patron subscriber, Edna. Thank you so much for being a patron subscriber. If you want to support this one-man show and sometimes Lydia, go to patreon.com/trueconsequences, and there's contribution amounts as small as $1. The higher you pay, the more stuff you get. There's even a hoodie that you can get if you are like the top level tier. Most of the levels include merch, so that's kind of cool. And I will send you a thank you note in the mail, old-fashioned style, that you won't be able to read because my handwriting is terrible.
Dear supporter.
Dearest Lydia.
War has been so hard.
It has been a fortnight since our last exchange.
Upon the new moon, I will be home.
Oh, God. Here we go. So you guys ready for some cackling? Okay. So, Lydia, we have two different stories we're doing today.
Yeah.
I'm going to start first. My story is completely crazy. And at first I was a little bit like, I don't want to cover it because you know how I am with old timey things. Like first I don't like history. Me.
But I've never heard you say, I don't like history. Me.
Well, I feel like I've said that a couple of times.
I said it with my eyes.
I said it with my heart. But you know, I get into this thing where I'm like, I don't really care about old timey stuff, but then I look into it and I'm like, holy shit, this is crazy. So I secretly like history. I'm a closet history buff. Not a buff of closet history, like not closets in particular.
Closet design organization.
This type of closet comes from, but I don't know. This is getting away from me really fast today. But I'm basically telling you one of the craziest unsolved stories in New Mexico history that is about the murder of the most hated guy in Taos, New Mexico. To this day, he's still the most hated guy in Taos, New Mexico.
Is there anyone even alive to remember him?
I don't know that they remember him, but I think they all hate him still.
So it's like something they tell their kids, like, you will never meet this person in your life. But if you did, you would hate him.
He was the worst person alive ever. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Are you ready to hear this story?
Hit me.
Okay. July 3rd, 1929 was a typical warm summer day in Taos, New Mexico. The average high in Taos in July is around 86 degrees. The weather was the only typical thing about July 3rd. A U.S. deputy marshal named Jim Martinez was traveling from Santa Fe in his car to Taos that day, described as a jalopy in the book, to process the land by Frank Waters, which is where I got most of the information about this case. Jim was on his way to serve a man named A.R. Manby with a notice that a lawsuit had been renewed against him. The lawsuit, from 1922, was already ruled on by a judge, and the plaintiff had been awarded a judgment against Manby. Manby had yet to pay the ordered fee, so in order to keep the matter open, Manby had to be served again prior to the 7-year mark of the judgment. Manby lived in a sprawling 19-room estate just steps from the Taos Plaza and just north of the famous Taos Inn. As Martinez pulled up to the home, he noticed several people standing near the gate. They informed him that there were rumors that Manby was dead. Nobody was shocked by this revelation, as Manby was the most hated man in Taos, and maybe even the most hated man in New Mexico at that time. Marshall Martinez entered the home and was hit with the overpowering stench of decomposition. Flies were swarming in the home, and they led the marshal into one of the bedrooms, where the bloated, discolored corpse of Manby lied headless. He was dressed in long underwear, a red sweatshirt, and a tan coat. Deputy Marshal Martinez then walked into the bedroom next door to the room where Manby's body was and found his head, which appeared to be disfigured on the right side. Coroners quickly decided that Manby died of natural causes, which, you know, obviously, and that one of his dogs most certainly had removed his head. Manby was buried quickly, and because he was so hated, he wasn't allowed to be buried in the Catholic or Protestant cemetery. So they put him just outside the cemetery.
So let's go back a bit here. Okay. So they think he died in his sleep of natural causes, or died of natural causes. Mm-hmm. And his dog hates him so much, too, or just got hungry. The dog just mauled his neck through.
Yeah.
And his head rolled into the other room, or maybe the dog carried it into the other room.
I think the dog carried it, yeah.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Just so we're clear.
It seems legit, you know. I mean, I guess if there was any cause for concern, they really didn't care anyway. They were just like, fuck this guy. Who cares? He died from natural causes. We're not going to investigate this.
Let's find the easiest way to just make this go away. But like the dog did it.
But the ultimate slap in the face was like, they're just like, let's just put him outside the graveyard because nobody wants to be buried next to him.
Why didn't they just let the dog finish the job?
I don't know. It doesn't seem like they were going to, right? Because they were just hanging out in the room with the corpse. So before I go into more detail on the mysterious death, I want to tell you a little bit more about who Arthur Rockford Manby was and why he was so hated by the residents of Taos. So Manby was born on July 14th, 1859, to Reverend Edward Francis and Emily Manby of Lancashire, England. I made sure that I said that properly. I asked my English friend.
Good.
Yeah. Arthur was number 8 of 9 children. So basically like you,
yeah,
that the couple would have had over the span of 14 years. So she's just popping him out. They didn't have cable back then, you know, so every year she's having another kid, basically.
Yeah.
Crazy. Catholic, English, all that fun stuff. Emily was an artist and Edward was, well, a reverend.
Okay. So none of them are paying bills. Like, there's just no money.
Actually, Edward was well off. He came from... like his family were lords and ladies, and they actually had a castle in Lancashire.
So he didn't really need to have a job.
Right. And I think the reverends back then of the abbeys, they were probably paid pretty well.
Interesting.
Because they were like, I feel like the Anglican church was like up there in like with the government. They were all kind of connected and, you know, they're well respected and whatever. Arthur grew up in a life of privilege and luxury. It is believed that he had dreams of owning large swaths of land and had little interest in remaining in the sleepy town that he grew up in. In Waters' book, he talks about a young Arthur being obsessed with building castles out of rocks and sand. Waters asserts that this speaks to the grandiose imperialistic nature of the young boy. He was creative and artistic just like his mother, and even developed a talent as a watercolor artist. Arthur's father died, and a few years later, Arthur boarded a boat to the U.S. It's believed that he had heard of the vast open spaces and mineral riches in New Mexico. So naturally, he had visions of taking advantage of the many land grants that were being given out by the government, and he had his heart set on the land of enchantment, which was a territory at that time, wasn't a state yet. He arrived in New York City and made his way here by train. And he arrived in Raton, which is like where you go, I guess, in June of 1883. For those of you that are from other places, Raton is a really small town on the border of New Mexico and Colorado, close to Trinidad, Colorado. It's in the mountains. That pass going into Colorado is really treacherous in the winter. That's all I need to say about it. It's pretty mountainous, mm-hmm. green, yeah. all that stuff. He was interested in the Maxwell Grant, also known as the Beaubien Miranda Land Grant, which took land away from local Jicarilla Apache tribes and gave it to colonial settlers in exchange for a promise that they would cultivate the land. It's much more complicated than this, but I'm not here to educate you on land grants of the Wild West, Lydia. So get off my back.
Get off my jock about the land grants.
So Manby began to negotiate with the land grant company in Cimarron in order to acquire a large enough ranch to raise cattle on. Like I said before, the whole land grant situation was super confusing.
I've been to Cimarron.
You have?
Yeah.
I don't think I have.
That's where that St. James Hotel is.
Oh, he stayed there.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, he stayed there whenever he was doing all of that. I was going to tell you that and I forgot. So thank you for reminding me. All right, so Manby quickly realized that he might be able to get more land than the original tract he purchased by manipulating the confusion surrounding land grants, right? So he bought his first plot of land in a remote area of the grant as a means to get a foothold in the community, and he started plotting and planning. Two of Arthur's siblings showed up to help him develop his land in an area known as Castle Rock, which is part of the Vermejo Ranch.
I've never heard of Castle Rock. Does it still exist?
It does. And you'll never see it in your life. You know why?
Why?
Because Ted Turner owns it.
Oh, so I have to date Ted Turner.
Yeah.
Okay.
Again.
Again. He told me the last time was the last time.
The order of protection is still there, Lydia. Nobody cares what we think is funny, and we're not that entertaining.
Yeah. Cackle, cackle.
So it seemed appropriately named to match his imperialistic desires. Castle Rock. It's important to know that the land grant company was doing everything it could to drive out the settlers living in the area of the grant. So basically what happened is there was a whole bunch of shit going on before this. Mexico owned New Mexico. The Spanish owned New Mexico. Mexico owned it again. I think France had it for a minute, maybe. I don't know. I might be messing that up. But basically there were like all these wars. The middle of it is all these native tribes that are being forced out of their lands. Mm-hmm. But every time a new leadership would take over this area, they would give land to their people. So they're like, these are all the Spaniards' land now. And then it was like, no, this is the Mexican people's land now.
Okay.
No, it's the French people's land. So it just kept kind of changing hands, but it ended up being like Spaniards / Mexican people living there. And they had been granted that, but like some of them were granted it by the Spanish king who no longer owned it. So it's all crazy. And New Mexico wasn't even a state yet. So the U.S. government really didn't know what to do with it. So the settlers are there and the land grant company is determined to kick all of these brown people out of there and let the white people come in and take over, like typically, right? So people like Manby were meant to make that happen. He was part of the whole scheme, like, oh, it's this English guy. He's giving us money. Go throw these other people out. Let's let him move in here.
Hmm.
As you can imagine, this did not make him very popular. He had a neighbor who was just simply named Griffin, who was also English. And they got into a big fight one day, and Griffin threatened Arthur with a gun, at least according to Arthur. Griffin was shot by Arthur's younger brother, Jocelyn. Not even playing. Not even joking. That's his name.
Maybe that's how it started, you know, as a
man's name?
Yeah.
I can't help but hear Moira Rose's voice, though, whenever I say Jocelyn. Jocelyn.
Jocelyn. Who's going to take care of the baby?
So Griffin was shot by Jocelyn and he died. The murder was ruled as self-protection by a judge, and Manby was not charged initially with a crime. But Griffin's widow was like, fuck this shit, and started harassing the court to press charges against Manby. And eventually they relented and charged.
I feel like it would have been really easy back then to just claim self-defense in every scenario.
Oh, totally. And that's basically what happened. Like, he went to the court and was like, yo, this guy, he pulled a gun on me and I had to kill him because he was going to kill me if I didn't kill him. And that was, and the judge was like, seems legit.
Well, he had a British accent, so of course everyone believed him.
Right.
Right. I doth protest.
And they didn't know what a jerk he was anyway. So they were just like, sure, sounds good. But his wife was fighting for justice, which is an interesting, I thought was an interesting thing to think about. that even back then, or maybe even especially back then, people were still trying to fight for justice for their murdered family members, which is something that we're still doing today, and which is why my show exists in the first place. It all comes full circle. Lydia's making a circle symbol with her hands. She pressed charges against him. The grant company helped him out, though, because, you know, there was a lot of political upheaval happening. The Civil War had just ended recently, and the territory was going back and forth between Democrat and Republican, just like it is now. Basically, everyone was mad at everybody. And so they're like, we're just going to wait till after the election because we're all really pissed off at each other. It's not time for a murder trial. We'll get back to this. And the land grant kind of helped to convince the judge to make that happen. And the land grant company had a lot of power at the time. So after the election, the land grant company was given an armed force by the governor of the territory to remove the settlers from the area. Basically, they were going to go in with guns and be like, get the fuck out.
Is it like a militia?
Basically. Yeah.
But they're just hired strictly by the land grant company.
They're appointed by the governor, and the land grant company is sort of like the head of the land grant company became the captain of the militia.
Got it.
Okay. Basically. But then they also recruited a bunch of local townspeople to help out. So because of all of these militia people going and like trying to kick these people out of their homes, there were riots. And so
riots on the street.
Riots on the street.
Or in the road.
And so the judge is like, yeah, we can't do the trial now. There's riots. Right.
Did you see the riots when you were coming down the alley?
So they held it off. The armed forces drove the settlers out of the area, and eventually things calmed down enough. So both Arthur and his brother Jocelyn were charged with Griffin's murder. Arthur asked the Maxwell Grant Company to provide him with a lawyer, and he had to make a choice between Frank Springer and Thomas Catron. Springer might sound like a familiar name to you. He's the guy that the town of Springer was named after. And guess what?
What?
He was also one of the original founding members of the Santa Fe Ring.
Oh, man. No way.
Yes.
And I recognize the name Catron, too.
Yeah.
We talked about.
Catron was a lovely fellow who fought in the Civil War for the Confederacy.
Lovely.
So nice. He was a trained lawyer, but was ousted from his community in Missouri because he fought against the Union.
Oh, you know what? Missouri is actually still very much into their Confederacy history.
Not back then. They threw him out. They're like, get out. So
Missouri threw him out for fighting for the Confederacy?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So he came to New Mexico, which was something that his friend was like, hey, you should just go to New Mexico. It's like nobody
cares.
Nobody knows you.
Nobody's going to Google you.
There's seven people there. It's fine.
You'll blend right in.
Catron became the district attorney in Santa Fe and eventually the attorney general for New Mexico. He was the leader of the Santa Fe Ring.
That's right.
So all of this is happening around the same time that Billy the Kid's like fucking around shooting people and all kinds
of things. Maybe it was Billy the Kid that killed him.
It could have been Billy the Kid that killed him. Although his MO wasn't to chop off people's heads either.
Well, maybe he ran out of bullets.
Maybe. It ended up that Arthur chose Catron to defend him, thinking that the jurors would be afraid of the leader of the ring. And it worked because Arthur and his brother were found not guilty after 2 years of the trial and everything happening. So not guilty. Not guilty does not mean innocent. And guilty does not mean they did it. Just in case anybody was wondering. Mambi was inspired by how easy it was to get around the conviction. So he started blatantly not giving a fuck about anything. He stopped paying taxes. He started running cattle through the land grant. And every time he was pursued legally, he somehow managed to get away virtually unscathed. His brothers eventually left Arthur, and he continued scheming, trying to carve out more and more land for himself. At some point, the Maxwell Land Grant Company kind of fell apart, and so they kicked Mambi and everybody out of the land grant, and he moved to Taos. He had heard that there might be another land grant that hadn't been touched. As soon as he figured that out, he started traveling around. He went to New York. He went back to England. He was courting investors to help him acquire the land. He was able to get 58,000 acres of the 61,000 that were available at that time.
Wow.
And the area included the now famous Mambi Hot Springs in Arroyo Hondo.
Wow, I've never heard of those hot springs.
So if you go between, there's two bridges. There's the Gorge Bridge, and then there's like a little bridge. If you go through Arroyo Hondo, you drive as far as you can. You drive right to the Rio Grande. Okay. You're in the gorge. And then you take a little hike a little bit south of there. There are three or four pools right next to the river of really hot water. And he owned that at the time. And it's actually named after him.
Interesting.
He loved them. He was there like all the time in the hot springs.
Naked, I'm sure.
100%.
That actually, naked as a blue jay.
That actually was in the book. Like he saw the hot, he found them because he was just like hiking down into the gorge. And he's like, I'm going to take off all my clothes and jump in this spring. So that's exactly how the author described it. He wanted to build a huge resort and hotel. Well, at least that's what he told his investors. But instead, he used the money to enrich himself.
And of course.
And build his giant house. He was an expert con artist. I feel like he has a lot of parallels with Dyson-Hassenkopf in the sense that he's like got all these grandiose stories about himself. And he thinks he's like this great guy. And everybody believes him. And he has all these people giving him money for no reason. So he duped his first investors. He was able to continue to get more and more investors without any issue. So like I said, he built himself a huge 19-room hacienda near what is now the Kit Carson Park in Taos. So there's a little excerpt I want to read from this book.
It's story time.
It's story time, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, crisscross applesauce.
Get your finger out of your nose, Lydia.
It wasn't in my nose.
If there had been something peculiar about him as a child, which prevented him from getting along with his family and neighbors, that same peculiarity set him apart from his more respectable American neighbors. It could not be rationally explained. He simply seemed to be a man whom no one knew or would ever know, nor did Manby know himself any better. Often it must have seemed to him, as it does to every man, that a nebulous shadow hovered about him, never visibly apparent but always present, as if it were a part of his own nature. If most men by childhood training and the pressures of society are taught to repress this shadow self as embodying the secret instincts and forces regarded as evil, Manby was under no such restrictions. Members of his family attest their tribulations in trying to control his willful impulses, but in New Mexico there are few restrictions of any kind. Manby found himself in a lawless land where men seemed free of all restraints and could vent to their greed and violence, and here Manby's shadow self came into full bloom with his association with Masterson and Lee and his killing of Griffin. How exhilarating it may have felt, this complete release into uninhibited freedom of action, this giving way to the dominance of his darker self, that there was in him another conflicting self he probably was not then aware. One only knows today that these first experiences in New Mexico impressed upon him a pattern of behavior that was never to be eradicated.
That is so pretty sounding. It's just like a very eloquent way of him of being described as being antisocial and oppositional defiant.
A psychopath.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is. It's interesting that they highlight that he would have been much more inclined to comply with like constraints imposed on him by, you know, the socioeconomic structure of his British heritage or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then here he's just like, nope, I'm going full on a-hole.
Going completely balls to the wall crazy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Balls to the wall. Oh, wait, that's not a song, is it?
It should be. It should be my theme song.
Okay.
Nobody cares what we think is funny, Lydia. You keep forgetting. Manby put himself massively in debt and started courting more investors to bail him out. He was eventually sued over 30 times. But in typical New Mexico fashion, he continued to get away with being a massive scheming prick, which is like how it is today.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to. I mean, if you have enough resources, you don't have to do anything you don't want to.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. Nothing matters. Okay. So while everyone was pissed off because he was scamming them, he started a secret society called, this is so ridiculous, United States Civil Secret Service Society.
That sounds like the post office police.
It's totally not a made up thing, Lydia. It's a real thing.
No, there are really post office police.
No, I'm saying the United States Civil Secret Service Society. So what is that? USCSSS? He would charge members insane amounts of money to join. And it's rumored that he would have people killed if they didn't pay up.
No, who would be doing the killing?
All the people that were in the USCSSS.
So is it like a cult?
Kind of. But he convinced all these people that like it was government sanctioned by the U.S. government and that they were carrying out secret missions on behalf of the government.
Shut
up. So he would be like, hey, Joe, I want you to go follow Fred Martinez around town and see what he's doing and then come back and tell me what's going on.
And so they thought that this was a legitimate government agency, like a shadow agency.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
And I thought I was stupid. No, I'd probably fall for that too.
Yeah, me too. So he started going on this crazy land grab and allegedly started employing the services of a local tarot card reader to tell people that their land was cursed in order to buy it off of them for cheap.
Oh my God.
He would harass and threaten people until they sold him their property. He even colluded with a judge to devalue the land that he wanted so that they could swoop in on it. And for some, like, he paid $53 for a total of 9,200 acres, which is about $1,500 today. And the rest of the land he bought for $126.
Shut up.
61,000 acres.
He is like Ted Turner.
Which meant that he now owned the entire land grant. He continued doing this to other landowners, which led to more and more people hating him. And it only added to his unpopularity in the community. But he didn't give a fuck. He didn't care. The local paper wrote an article about Manby's shady ass dealings, and he did what any egotistical maniac would do and attacked the editor with a knife.
Like, did he hurt him?
So he slashed at the guy's arm, and then luckily the editor wasn't cut so bad. So he grabbed the chair and broke it over Manby's head and then took off. But he wasn't finished. So he was like, okay, well, that's not enough to dissuade me. He started a fraudulent company called the Taos Valley Land Company. The entire purpose of purchasing and cultivating lands, including mineral-rich lands, he also wanted to acquire the rights of all the water in the area. So owning all the land wasn't enough. He literally wanted to own all the streams and rivers and everything. He had grandiose plans of seeding his own towns and cities and building dams and reservoirs, and he continued to dupe investors into giving him money for his new company. And as if it couldn't get any worse, it does. At the age of 48, he married the 16-year-old daughter of one of his investors.
Gross.
Yeah.
Ew.
Yeah. He lied and said he was 42 and had her lie and say that she was 17. I mean, I guess, you know, the age of consent is 17, I think, here in New Mexico. She got pregnant and then she had a miscarriage or a stillbirth. But he was the worst husband you can imagine. And so they eventually got divorced. But he was actual scum. So the rest of the story gets really complicated, but essentially he starts floundering and he runs out of money. His investors get impatient with him and he starts scheming to move things around, but inevitably he ends up broke. So what does he do? He creates more and more companies and furiously starts transferring assets around like a game of hot potato. He's like, these water rights go to this company. Just kidding. No, they're going to go to this company. This land's going to go over here. And he just kept doing that, like, over a series of weeks where nobody even knew what was going on. And they even said the county clerk had to work long into the night every day because he kept doing crazy ass shit like this. He thought that this was going to help him secure his assets. Like, they wouldn't be able to stop him from owning everything. I don't know. But through all of this, he was able to somehow secure the water rights to nearly the entire Taos Valley. And then the lawsuits started pouring in one after another as people realized they had been duped into giving money to a con man. By 1914, his debtors started calling him in on his debts. So he does what any good con man can be expected to do and heads straight to the poker table.
I just need one good hand.
So he tries to win money. So he sits down, but he decides that he's above that. He's above all of those people. He's too good for it, and he walks out. He actually doesn't end up gambling. But I just thought it was funny that he thought he was going to try to win them all the money that he owed. And it was like hundreds of thousands of dollars at this point. So the court cases piled up against him. He was ordered by the courts to auction off all of his land to the highest bidder in order to recoup all the massive amounts of debts that he had accrued. His lawyers were even getting in on all of these lawsuits because he owed them money as well. Eventually he lost all. Yeah. Yeah. It's like it's like a meteoric rise and then a super hard crash. Eventually he lost all the land that he had, quote, worked so hard to steal and manipulate to own. So this is why nobody was surprised when he ended up dead. Everyone's like, good.
He had it coming. He had it coming.
It literally could have been anybody who killed him.
Right. His list of enemies was endless.
It was forever. Right. So he had so many enemies and was hated by so many of the people of Taos that it wasn't shocking at all that he was found dead. But here's the thing. Remember when we were recording Billy the Kid and there were so many rumors that he faked his death?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same thing happened here. People started speculating that he was seen in Colorado, New York, Italy, Florida. There were also speculations in the press that Mambi was one of five similar homicides in New Mexico at the time. And they listed them all off. I'll read it for you. Hold on. Should I try to read it like a 1920s newspaper?
Yeah, person? Like a newsie.
I don't know if I can do it. Headless body number five in the mystery of the Spanish mansion. No, I can't do it.
No, that was good. Yeah? Keep going. Yeah.
The spread was profusely illustrated with photos of Mambi, Princess Teresita, Old Man Ferguson before he began to see visions of headless bodies and was sent into the insane asylum. And a close-up of Mambi's front door with three different kinds of locks mounted on it, according to the article. Mambi was a fifth man of a small group to die as he had mysteriously and to be found head and body separated. I'm done.
That was good.
In the days when the Aztec and mystic minds were going full blast, old residents recall at least three other decapitation slayings in the neighborhood. All were minors. And it is rumored that all three had been connected in ways not clear and either the mystic or Aztec. One of the five, only Mambi, Stone, and Wilkerson were identified. Sorry, of the five. So only three of them were identified. Hmm. They didn't know who the other two were. This was followed by an AP dispatch reported that Mambi's death is a matter of international note because of the intervention of the United States Department of Justice at the request of the British Embassy. The Kansas City Star gave more details. At the request of the British Embassy, the American government, through the Department of Justice, has launched an investigation. The State Department communicated with the Attorney General, who ordered an investigation by the El Paso Office of the Bureau of Investigation. 2 days later, the Star came out with a double-page illustrated spread, 13 full columns on the case. Governor Dillon had indeed sent the case to the British consulate in Galveston, which in turn had forwarded to the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. The assumption behind the intervention of Her Majesty's government in the case was that Mambi was a British subject. Jocelyn B. Mambi affirmed this with a public statement headed, "Mambi never U.S. citizen, says brother," stating that Mambi had taken out first naturalization papers in 1883, but had let the application go by default and returned to England for a visit in the 90s. 1890s, not 1990s. I like to imagine him with a mullet, though.
In hammer pants.
His application of 1899 was but a renewal of the first. This was denied by a Santa Fe attorney who asserted Mambi had been admitted to a citizenship in the District Court of Taos County on December 4th, 1899. While this international controversy was going on, another state argument got underway as reflected in the Santa Fe, New Mexico front page. I'm not going to read that. But basically, there was a bunch of speculation in the press about what was going on. A lot of people thought he was still alive. They thought maybe he was actually a spy. People even thought maybe the United States Secret Service Society, Civil Secret Service Society was a real thing. I don't know if any of that was true. It isn't clear why these rumors popped up. Maybe it was because he was so in debt. I believe it was close to $1 million by the time he died. Maybe it was because people felt he was so devious that they wouldn't put it past him to do something so crazy and selfish as fake his own death. Either way, there was a lot of speculation around his death. Another interesting thing is that the coroner, Doc Martin, which I don't know if you've ever been to Taos, but there's a restaurant called Doc Martin's. It's really good.
Oh.
It's said to have destroyed the results of the autopsy because the state refused to pay him for it. So he burned them.
Oh, that'll show him.
And that's the mysterious death of the most hated man in New Mexico, Arthur Rockford Mambi.
That is totally crazy. I was not expecting that at all.
I wasn't either. I was really shocked when I started looking into it, how insane the story was.
I had no idea it was so out of control.
Lydia, what are you going to tell us about?
I'm going to tell you about the disappearance of two couples who were traveling together from Illinois to New Mexico when they mysteriously vanished without a trace.
At the same time?
At the same time. They were traveling together. The year was 1935. What was happening in 1935?
People were wearing finger waves in their hair, right?
Yeah, I'll answer that question.
Oh, that was a rhetorical question. Sorry.
So what was going on in 1935? So oddly enough, it's the same year that the trial began for the accused kidnapper of Charles Lindbergh Jr., the Lindbergh baby. Amelia Earhart became the first person to fly solo from Hawaii to California. The FBI killed the Barker gang, including Ma Barker.
Why did you say it like that?
Ma Barker. I'm sure she was crazy, Ma Barker. And Porky Pig made his debut on Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
And the Dust Bowl.
Mm. So, not to be confused with the Super Bowl.
No, no. I don't think that they're related.
Okay.
I don't know anything about sports.
Me either. Me either.
So, in the 1930s, the Great Depression has a huge impact on the expansion of our federal highway program. So, many in Congress were calling on funds to expand the highway program to create jobs and expand the use of tolls that would hopefully generate some maintenance financing. Mm. So, American engineers actually went to Germany and saw the Autobahn and were totally impressed and tried to recreate that in the United States in order to help facilitate some jobs and an economic stimulation during the Great Depression. And so with the development of our interstate highway system, Americans were on the move. The Great Depression led to many Americans throughout the country looking for work. Jobs were lost, homes were foreclosed, people left their homes to seek new lives. But even with all those things and everyone facing dire straits, there were still a few Americans who were able to eke out a few times of travel just for leisure.
Hmm.
So George Laureus, an ice company executive from East St. Louis, Illinois, and his wife.
Wait, what?
East St. Louis, Illinois.
Is that a place?
Yeah. So there's St. Louis, Missouri, and then there's like a small sliver of like a river.
Oh.
Right? It's a river?
I guess. I don't know.
The Missouri River?
Sure.
Sure. And then on the other side is Illinois.
Oh. So... So St. Louis kind of bleeds over into Illinois.
Right. But it's no longer St. Louis, Missouri.
It's St. Louis, Illinois. Got it. Oh, sorry.
I didn't know that either. Yeah. I mean, my husband's from St. Louis. So I just thought there was one St. Louis.
Interesting.
So, you know, some people were still able to go and enjoy the open roads for leisure activities. Mm-hmm. So George Laureus, he was an ice company executive, his wife, Laura, and they had two friends, a couple named Albert and Tilly. I like that name, Tilly. Baby name ideas. they hit the road in their 1929 Nash, and I looked at the car.
I'm Googling it.
Yeah, it's a cool car. Maybe it was like a moderate income car to have at the time. I mean, it's pretty stylish.
Oh, that is a sexy car.
Yeah, so they hopped in it, and their goal was to explore the Southwest. So I would imagine that couples from the Midwest thought that the Southwest was kind of like an easily accessible, exotic locale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people probably had like fantasies of what Native Americans were like. And
I feel like that's still like how it is now.
That is true. Yeah.
I mean, have you ever had, okay, sorry, I'm going to interrupt you, but
no, you're good.
Have you ever had that thing where you tell someone you're from New Mexico and then they think you say Mexico?
Oh, all the time.
So can I just like segue into that little quick story? Cause it's hilarious. All right. So I'm coming back from Las Vegas, Nevada. I was in Vegas for work and.
For work?
Yeah. So basically, I go to the airport, right, in Vegas. I'm coming home, and I go to TSA, and you know the drill. You, like, show your ID and your boarding pass.
Flash your boobs.
Well, no, but yes, okay, sure. So I handed my ID and my boarding pass over to the guy, and he's, like, stood there staring at it for a long time. Like, way longer than I thought he should be staring at my license. I'm like, what the fuck? Is he, like, memorizing it or something? Okay. So he looks at me. He looks back at my license and he goes, I can't accept this. And I looked at him and I said, why not? And he said,
like emotionally, spiritually, like, what do you mean?
What are you talking about? And he said, we don't accept international driver's licenses. And so I stood there and like, I bet you my mouth was open, right? I stood there and I was just like, I took a deep breath and I said, you might want to just take a minute and think about what you just said. And he looked really confused. And then he looked back at my license. And he looked back at me. And then he just said, okay, I guess you could go ahead, sir. I said, just so you know, New Mexico is part of the U.S. This isn't a new thing. It's been, it's been a state for a long time.
He just wasn't sure. He was making sure. This is true. I mean, I've had teachers ask me before, you know, being from New Mexico, they asked us if we could drink the water here, if we use American dollars. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you're a teacher. You should know this. You're not very good at your job.
All right, your turn.
Okay. So the couple hits the road. They want to explore the Southwest.
Okay.
So the gas was 19 cents a gallon. I actually went and looked this up in 1935. Mm-hmm. So it was actually probably an affordable way to travel. Probably not the most comfortable, but still affordable. And the highway system opened up new worlds. So they made their way to New Mexico in May of 1935. They traveled to Vaughan, New Mexico. Vaughan is roughly an hour and a half away from Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm. I've been there. It's really small.
It's really small. Now it's technically considered a ghost town because there's less than 400 people living there.
They have an Allsup's, and I used to stop there for a chimmy.
Oh, the chimichangas.
From Allsup's, yeah. Whenever we would, because I used to live in Tucumcari for a minute, like 5 minutes.
When did you live in Tucumcari?
In the late 80s when New Kids on the Block were a thing.
Oh, okay. So that was why you had to move to
That's exactly why.
I didn't want Donnie to know where I lived. So they ended up in Vaughan, New Mexico. And you might be wondering, like, why would they choose Vaughan as their stopping point? So apparently George Laureus wanted to visit a nurse who had cared for him some years prior, and she had moved to Vaughan. And so they went to Vaughan to go, like, hang out with her and have, like, breakfast with her.
Okay.
That sounds a little bit suspicious, right?
I bet you they were dating.
Yep. That's what I thought, too.
She was a mistress, yeah.
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 But he's with his wife and their, you know, couple friends.
Which is why he's like, this is the nurse that took care of me.
Right. You know all those baths she gave me? So they stayed at the Vaughan Hotel.
Okay.
It's no longer there. It's been torn down. They stayed the night there. The next morning, they had breakfast there. And that was the last time anybody ever saw them.
What?
Like a confirmed sighting.
They just disappeared.
They just disappeared. Both couples, because they're traveling together. The case has never been officially closed, but it's certainly gone cold. So an officer with the New Mexico State Police has decided to start dedicating his free time to trying to figure out if he could try to solve this case. So it's never been officially closed, but it's definitely gone cold. And an officer with the New Mexico State Police decided to dedicate whatever free time he had to absorbing all he could about the case. Also, the descendants of the Laureus family decided to also do the same thing. So there's been many areas, many connections where they've been trying to figure out what happened to these four people. So Don Ashcroft, who is a relative of the Laureus couple, he wrote, "Our contention is that the bodies are still in Vaughan. Though I'm not at liberty to divulge why at this point, he believes that they were killed in Vaughan and that they're buried there. Their disappearance quickly evolved into a long trail of clues, but none of which produced their bodies or who may be responsible. Some of their belongings were found smoldering in a heap on Albuquerque's east side, where Knob Hill is today."
Whoa.
Yeah. More belongings were dumped in El Paso.
What?
And the 1929 Nash was found abandoned in Dallas, Texas.
Holy shit.
The vehicle showed signs of damage and that was potentially caused by multiple accidents. All of the pieces scattered over several states resulted in one of New Mexico's largest manhunts. According to the Albuquerque Journal, every single state police officer, all 27 of them at the time, along with 15 National Guardsmen, 20 members of the 111th Cavalry, and 100-plus volunteering Albuquerqueans scoured the East Mesas and Tijeras Canyon. A dragnet of vehicles and walkers 6 miles long combed the miles from Albuquerque to Willard. I don't know where Willard is.
I think Willard is on the way to Vaughan.
Oh, okay. The search centered on Socorro, where we're from. They looked in Carrizozo, San Marcial, Gallup, Quemado, Rio Puerco, the Rio Grande. A high-profile case attracts lots of junior detectives, the Albuquerque Journal writes. Someone reported blood on a bush, another a blood-stained bedspread. A woman in Madrid remembered two men borrowing a shovel at 2 a.m. that she thought was suspicious. A pair of shorts turned up on a street in Gallup. Some 300 suspects were detained and questioned as police looked for a man fitting the description of a probable killer, a dark youth with a tattooed arm.
Mm.
I don't know where they came up with the description of a dark youth, but it sounds pretty racist to me.
For sure.
After they've, you know, come up with like these 300 suspects, you know, the family and the state police detective who's still currently trying to solve this case talked about what he thought may have happened to them.
Okay.
While they were in Vaughn, they allegedly mailed two postcards to friends and family. One of the postcards read, "Came through this place in the AM, no trouble of any kind," was the note jotted on the card. And the other one said, "Going to Boulder Dam," which was now the Hoover Dam.
Okay.
Then to Los Angeles. But of course, they never reached their final destination. So according to Officer Rhodes with the New Mexico State Police, the two postcards, among all that evidence, convinced Rhodes that the couple spent the night in Vaughn and then hit the road towards Albuquerque the next morning. He believed that they used Route 66. Mm. So from Santa Rosa north to Las Vegas and then to Albuquerque through Santa Fe. Josephine Ward, a clerk at the Sturgis Hotel in Albuquerque at the time, swore to investigators that the couples came to the hotel that afternoon inquiring about renting rooms. She said that they wanted to rent a room just for an hour just to take a bath, and it cost them $1. They said that they were going on their way to Gallup and they were going to try to get to Gallup by nightfall. So that's what this clerk in a hotel told investigators that she observed. So, but according to the ancestors of the families, Barbara Ashcroft, she's the great niece of the couple. She says that her late great uncle, another uncle, an Albuquerque real estate agent named Walter Duke, spent his life investigating the case too, and he compiled his own thick file. He believed the couples met their killer and their end in Vaughn.
That's what it sounds like. Whenever you brought up the clerk saying that, I feel like she was just trying to get her nose involved in it or something, mm-hmm. because it just doesn't seem likely.
Right.
Anyway.
So when they pressed Don for details, he said that in 1963, he received a letter from a woman who identified herself as a waitress from Berlin, who said she worked in Vaughn in 1935, and she herself witnessed the murders.
What?
She said that she was present when the couple was taken into the basement of a cafe, and they were murdered. They said they poured concrete over them and left them there.
Whoa.
So the Vaughn Hotel and the cafe don't exist anymore. But the descendants of the couples believe that any concrete slabs in Vaughn need to be examined because they believe that that's where the bodies are.
So, I mean, do you know if anybody's taken like ground penetrating radar or anything out there?
No, it doesn't sound like anybody's done any investigation in Vaughn.
I know
in any concrete slabs.
Those pieces of equipment are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I almost wish I had one because I would be like going everywhere trying to find bodies.
I know. So the descendants believe that the couple was killed during a robbery mm-hmm. and that there was probably more than one criminal involved.
Oh, like they robbed the cafe and they were there?
Well, just involved, like they were robbing the couples.
Oh.
And that maybe people in the cafe or the hotel were involved, allowing them access to the basement. And they think that there had to have been more than one criminal involved because they think that everyone split up. So somebody took the car, somebody took the belongings, and somebody maybe forged the postcards and mailed them off.
Wow.
So, and here's the really creepy part. You want to hear the really, really creepy part?
It gets creepier?
I think this is so interesting because I definitely believe in the supernatural.
Okay.
So, a chilling piece of information. On May 22nd, 1935, the sister of Laura Laureus, the wife, woke up in a fright in Illinois. And she told her husband that she had had a dream about her sister. Her sister came to her in a dream and said, "I've been murdered. I'm under a floor in a building, and it will be very hard for you to find me." This was before she had any indication that her sister was in danger or was missing.
Whoa.
The other theory that was floated was that a murderous criminal who had been released from prison in Texas named Chester Comer, he was an oil field worker, and he himself had had two missing wives, was released around the same time about their disappearance. And it was around the same areas that he was known to frequent. They believe that the tourist went missing, that he may have had something to do with it. When he was back in Oklahoma, he got into a gunfight. And on his deathbed, he started mumbling something incoherently about bodies hidden in the trees of Tijeras. So people speculate that maybe he was the one that killed the couples traveling.
Did you look into this guy?
I looked up his picture.
He's in Murderpedia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he is a spree killer, which is what they called him back then, but probably a serial killer. He has five known victims. The most, like, the ones that they know of were in 1935 in November.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So it would have been, it could have fit the same time frame.
Yeah, they're saying his ex-wife, Elizabeth, his second wife, Lucille, he murdered her, both of them. He murdered somebody named Ray Evans. He murdered a farmer and his son. Yeah. And he was killed during a shootout in November of 1935, actually.
See, it's still, I mean, he was alive in May.
Yeah.
So during his, when he was injured in that shootout, while he was dying in the hospital.
That's when he was murmuring.
Yep. About the bodies in Tejeras. Those are all the potential theories. The state police detective who is still kind of working on the case believes that they did try to make it to Gallup, and he thinks that somebody intercepted them between Albuquerque and Gallup. So
the investigator thinks that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because he believes that the postcards were legitimate, that they were actually mailed from Vaughn by the couples.
That they took a bath in Albuquerque.
They took a bath in Albuquerque, and then they hit the road underestimating how long it would take them to get to Gallup. And so somewhere between Albuquerque and Gallup, they met their end.
Huh.
In 1942, the estate of the families petitioned to have them declared dead, so about 10 years later. And that's where we are now. There's no other information other than the families focusing on it and this one state police officer. Nobody's else really focusing on trying to figure out what happened to this cold case.
What do you think happened?
I actually believe the Vaughn version, that something happened in Vaughn.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they were leaving. Maybe they got into a scuffle. You know,
mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they take a bath in Vaughn before they leave Vaughn?
Right. It doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you drive from Vaughn to Albuquerque, then take a bath?
That's weird.
Right.
Huh.
Unless you were really sweaty, but it's May.
Could be warm.
Yeah.
There's no air conditioning back then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems Vaughn was so desolate. There's so few people there.
Yeah.
If it's such a small community, I could imagine people covering up for each other.
That was a crazy story.
Yeah. And I do believe this waitress who wrote that letter, she was probably older at that time. So mm-hmm. It was 30 years after a potential murder. She writes to a family member of one of the victims and says, I need to tell you this.
Well, I mean, what would she have to gain in doing that? You know what I mean? Like, why would, if it's someone so many years later, like, what would she have to gain in being dishonest? You know what I mean? Like, why would she even go to all that trouble anyway if she didn't actually see something, if something didn't actually happen?
Yeah.
That was a long way to say that.
And I do feel like there's a lot of people who try to like clear their conscience before mm-hmm. they die.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to write a letter about all the awful things I did.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you for listening and stay safe, New Mexico.
Thanks for listening to True Consequences. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at True Consequences Pod and on Twitter at True Cons Pod. True Consequences is listener supported. If you'd like to support this one-man show, please go to patreon.com/trueconsequences. Thanks for listening, and stay safe, New Mexico.